And we're going to continue in this seminar series of Sangharakshita classics, where we're exploring each week one of Sangharakshita's lectures, and he's given hundreds of lectures over the years, particularly in the early days of the Triratna order and community, where he was doing all the teaching. And the lecture that we're going to look at today, well, actually, we're going to look at an extract from a lecture, and it's an extract that's in this book, The Essential Sangharakshita, and it's a Buddhist approach to world problems, You can find the full unedited lecture itself on Free Buddhist Audio, where I think it's called Evolution or Extinction, a Buddhist approach to world problems. So it's called Evolution or Extinction, a Buddhist approach to world problems. And yeah, the unedited full lecture, it's really worth listening to, but I'm not going to touch on all the things that it touches on. It goes into areas that I'm not going to, mainly due to time, have time to talk about today. But Banti talks about, he starts off, and this lecture was given in the early 70s, by the way. So when I was looking at it, I thought, well, maybe that's going to be relevant because the world's moved on in the last 40 years or something. But actually, the lecture stands just as much. The world's moved on, but the world problems, if anything, have just got more complex, haven't they? They've become more complex. But they're of the same order of stuff, world problems. He starts off, though, by saying that he talks about what he's not going to do. He reminisces about India. He spent 20 years in India, most of that time as a Buddhist monk. And he was often invited to speak at Buddhist gatherings or meetings or large just gatherings of lectures. And he says that in India they really like their lectures and their meetings long. They pride themselves on having speaker after speaker after speaker, and a good meeting is one that goes on for hours and hours and hours. And he recalls one time he was asked to, just as he was getting up to speak, one of the organisers said, you know, speak for at least 2 hours, and that would be a good meeting. And he said that people in India are very generous with their time. And they're also very generous with other people's time. and he said that he often heard people speakers talking about Buddhism and world problems. And he said that all the talks, all the lectures would follow the same sort of basic template. First of all, the speaker would begin by talking about the world's problems, and they would conjure up images of, well, political, economic, social injustice, wars, famines, well, you can imagine all the sort of problems that, in a way, are very, very familiar to us. They would conjure all these up, and then they would say something like, and the solution is for everybody to become a Buddhist. And if everybody became a Buddhist, then the world wouldn't have any its problems. And Sangharakshita says that he's not going to do that tonight. Not because it's not true. He says that the problem with that sort of solution isn't that it's not true, because actually if everybody became a Buddhist, if everybody was trying to practice mindfulness and kindness and generosity and compassion and empathy and fearlessness and understanding and all of those kind of Buddhist virtues, then a substantial number of the world's problems probably could be eliminated. So it's not that it's not true, it's just quite a simplistic answer that won't actually get us anywhere, because it's never going to happen. Yeah? It's some sort of dream solution that might well create a just, fair... Well, Banti talks about heaven on earth. It might well create that. but it's not going to happen. And he said the typical response to these talks was everybody would get very, very roused and cheer and applaud very loudly and then go home and nothing would change. Nothing at all would happen. So he doesn't want to do that. He says also, it's not just that it's a simplistic solution, which it is, but also it rather makes Buddhism the only sort of answer. Because actually, there are other people who are not Buddhists who are also trying to live and work for peace and justice and kindness and awareness and empathy. And, you know, he just says, you know, if everybody followed Jainism or Taoism or certain forms of Hinduism, you would still get world peace without any need to mention Buddhism. He said that actually there's no need to even talk about religion at all. If everybody followed the teachings of Plato, and he says, or even Bertrand Russell, you would still get world peace on the spot if everybody did that. So Buddhism isn't a panacea, and besides, not everybody is going to adopt it as a discipline. And then he says, well, okay, so Buddhism's not a panacea, and not everybody's going to adopt it, but as a Buddhist, what can we do? What does Buddhism offer? If you are practicing Buddhism, what can you do? What does it offer in terms of world problems? And the first thing he says is that there isn't a Buddhist party line. There isn't a single Buddhist view that everybody would, all Buddhists would concur with. There isn't the Buddhist position on anything, actually, on any world issue. There would only, I guess, be Buddhist consensus on the very fundamentals of a spiritual life, the very fundamentals of the Buddhist teaching. But in terms of social, economic, political kind of views, there isn't going to be the Buddhist position. So what he says is that he's just going to talk about his view. And it's a Buddhist view. It's just his view. And it's his view as a Buddhist who's been, at that stage, he'd been practicing for over 30 years. He says that this issue of how to respond to the world is very, very much dear to him. He's not just practicing Buddhism for his own sort of personal well-being. He's very, very concerned about how, as a Buddhist, does he respond to the issues of the world. He says that my view of current world problems constitutes a sort of philosophical autobiography, even a confession of faith. It will, I hope, show where I stand, and perhaps to some extent why I stand there. So it's a personal statement of what he is doing with his life. Yeah. That's how he's going to approach this issue. So is that clear so far? Does that, you can sort of follow where his reasoning is going so far. So then, of course, he says, well, we ought to at least say what sort of world problems are we talking about. And he said we can probably all make our own list. And we probably don't need reminding of them. Most of them have been with us from the dawn of history. He says what's changed in modern times is not perhaps the nature of the problems, but the scale of them. The scale has changed. And also the fact that we are this global community now. So we hear about everything going on everywhere, pretty much. you know, he says that it's not that long ago that you could have had countries where people really wouldn't have been aware what was happening even a few valleys away. It wasn't unheard of for a country to be at war and for some, I don't know, rural farmers and peasants not to be affected by the situation in their country, not to even really know what was happening. And of course that's just not the world that we live in now. And he was talking in the pre-internet days, so you know, it applies so much more now. So yes, he's talking about globalization and the fact that we can't ignore now problems that might not directly impinge on our lives because we know about them. So I'm just going to read some of what he says about these world problems. So we have the world's problems at our fingertips. The real problem for us is to how to respond to them personally. How do we ensure that every individual citizen in the world grows up healthy and sound in body and mind? What can be done about the apparently increasing incidence of mental illness in the West? What is the role of women and what is the role of men in modern society? How do people with jobs avoid making themselves ill through overwork? How do people without work make the best use of their enforced leisure? How do we ensure that people are not discriminated against or abused on account of their racial origin? How do we reconcile the claims of law and order with those of individual freedom? How do we reconcile the conflicting interests of sovereign nation states? How can we all get along with one another? So it's just very topical now, isn't it? Very, very topical. I mean, I was just, you know, reading about Julian Assange and the diplomatic crisis that the whole WikiLeaks scandal and his impending trial in Sweden, all of that has suddenly embroiled Britain, Sweden, Ecuador, of all places, as it were, and the United States in something that, you couldn't have imagined before it happened. And on the one side, you've got the claims of law and order that say, no, a man accused of, in his case, sexual crimes must stand trial. And in his argument, he's talking about freedom of speech and how he's being persecuted for not even a whistleblower, but he's published things, hasn't he, that the governments, of particularly the US, would have rather have suppressed. So you've got this very startling case, and you've also got who are they? Pussy Riot. And Putin imprisoning these three young women for, I think it's like 2 years that they've been imprisoned for. And what were they doing? They were protesting against Putin in a church. And you've got the claims of, I guess, the Orthodox Russian Christians who were appalled at their what they would have considered blasphemy. You've got Putin who would want to stifle any protest probably against him. And then you've got the notion of free speech and the right to protest against oppression. And you've got, again, the whole world sort of not knowing what to do with that. You know, there are all sorts of petitions online and Amnesty International are involved, etc., etc. But what do you do? What do you do as an individual? You can do something, but it's not obvious what effect that will have. I'm going to read a bit more. It's similar, but I think it's worth just contemplating. So fresh outbreaks of hostilities between rival factions in some former European colony. Food shortages and unrest in some ex-communist state. Inner city deprivation and crime. Drug dependency and alcoholism. Child labour. Racial violence, industrial pollution, nuclear accidents, disease, drought, famine, starvation, ethnic cleansing. These are just few of the problems, a few of the problems and crises that confront us. Or at least pluck at our heart's sleeves every now and then, and are recorded for us on the television and analysed for us in the newspapers. No doubt there are many others, equally pressing, which I have failed to mention. We all have our own pet world problems, which seem even more critical than others. But the central problem for all of us is, how do we ourselves individually react to whatever we perceive to be the world's problems? So he's saying, what do we do? What do we do? So let me just pause there and see if there are any responses to anything that I've said, whether that chimes with you, or whether there are any responses or even disagreements that it provokes.
I think what you said about it being more, that people know more about these kind of things, whereas
yeah.
they wouldn't if you used to have known, I think
yeah.
that creates a heightened sense of responsibility, perhaps.
Yeah.
Especially perhaps in the younger generations with technologies at fingertips, and they can sign petitions and things like that.
Yeah. And you do see that, don't you, that people globally are behaving with more responsibility to some of these issues, trying to tackle them. Ordinary people, through using technology particularly, are trying to do things, sometimes effectively, sometimes able to convince politicians, etc., to act differently. Yeah. So
I think
the
question
is
about how we react to things. I think that's kind of how I react. I think, oh, what could I do?
Yeah.
What's the responsibilities? It feels a bit like a burden.
Yeah. So in a way, we've got limited means, but what limited means we have, we can do something with. What's interesting is, over and above that, if we're Buddhists, is there anything else that we should be doing? Yeah. Shall I move on and see what he has to say about that? So first of all, he says that it's very, very common for people to have kind of two slightly contradictory reactions to big issues. One is this indignation and anger and outrage even, that says something should be done. Something should be done. We've got to do something. This is outrageous. Do you recognise that in yourself? Do you recognise that indignation? And he says, but that's often followed by a slightly different reaction, which is, oh, it's too big, it's too overwhelming, I can't do anything, we can't do anything. And a feeling of powerlessness and helplessness in the face of the size and the complexity of the issues involved. Do you recognise that? This sort of overwhelming stuff. I sometimes feel this with, you know, the environmental crisis. So I try and, well, I live in a community which is sort of ecologically probably a more efficient way of living than living on my own. And we do try and do recycling and whatever. And sometimes I think, you know, so I'm recycling my plastic in the face of something enormous. You know, what will that kind of do? I mean, I still do it, fortunately, partly because the community sort of has that ethos, but I can sort of even start to doubt, you know, whether I can make a difference. So it is perhaps easy, if you get into that overwhelmed state, to think, well, I can't do anything, and I'm therefore just going to get on with my own life and not worry about anything bigger. Yeah. And his response, Sangharakshita's response to that is, he says, well, however, my own view is that such an attitude of withdrawal from public concerns into purely personal ones is one that is not worthy of a human being. Not worthy, at least, of someone who is trying to be a human being in the full sense of the term. It represents an abdication of responsibility. So that's strong, isn't it? It's not worthy of a human being. So I wonder if there's a sort of something here that just needs exploring a little bit, which is what does Sangharakshita mean by somebody who's trying to be a full human being in his terms? What do you think he's trying to get at by him using a full human being?
I think a lot of it is the idea of compassion, and that especially as a practicing Buddhist, you are opening up to the connection that you have to everybody else on the planet.
Yeah.
But you're doing it with your self-work.
Yeah.
And if you hope to connect to everyone and have compassion,
yeah.
But then you shut down in that way, it's just as detrimental to yourself as it is to everyone around you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That puts it really, really well. That if you're trying to follow Buddhist ideals, compassion being one of the central ones, but also awareness of the consequences of our actions on others and the world around us. If we're going to try and wake up to reality, then we should be practicing those ideals. And to the extent that we close ourselves off from the world around us and the issues of the world around us, to that extent, not only are we not helping the world around us, but we're not helping ourselves as Buddhist practitioners trying to move towards enlightenment.
I think it's a fine line then, because as well, on the same side of the sort of righteous indignation,
yeah,
that is another attitude and mindset that isn't,
yeah,
particularly embraced.
Yeah.
So it becomes a difficulty between aversion and aggression.
Exactly.
And finding
a middle way. Exactly. So yes, righteous indignation isn't a Buddhist virtue. In fact, it would be seen as unskillful. Why is that? Maybe that's obvious, but why is that? I think it's just worth really understanding why that is. Because not all religious traditions would see righteous indignation as a bad thing. So for example, I, until recently, was involved in a local communities organising group called Telco. And they tried to get together different community groups in the East End, religious groups but also secular groups like unions and schools and things, to effect change. It's a sort of group which helped people wake up to citizenship and individual responsibility. Really, really good. Really, really good. But one of their real angles at trying to motivate people was to encourage righteous indignation and outrage and anger, righteous anger, and that would therefore be a motivating thing. And I wasn't alone in not quite agreeing with that. And what is the problem with that? Right, so you're not looking at the other person's point of view.
How do you know which issues are real and which ones are made up?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So hold that. Let's come back to that. But let's stick with what's wrong with, from a Buddhist perspective, with righteous indignation and anger. So one is that you're not looking at the other person's view.
It's another barrier to having compassion.
It's another?
Barrier to having compassion.
It's a barrier to having compassion. Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's intoxicating as well.
it's intoxicating. Can you say a bit more about what you mean by that?
When I let my anger go, I'm out of control.
Right.
And I find myself just dwelling in the anger.
Yeah.
And then I find myself acting and thinking unskillfully.
Yeah.
Negatively.
Yeah.
It's intoxicating.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just lose clarity.
Yeah. Yeah. So what Buddhism's saying in terms of the law of karma, it's saying that our mental states will colour and affect the outcome of our actions. So if we're acting from anger, then the effects of our actions, they're misleading because we can sort of imagine them at our level. We can imagine wrathfulness at our level, but it's not at our level. It's not anger. It's actually energy that is an internal energy that destroys egotism. It's not anger directed at the world outside. It's an energy that sort of burns away our self-clinging. And that energy is so powerful, it's said, it's so powerful that one way of symbolising it is in these wrathful figures, you know, surrounded by halos of flame. But that what they're not doing is reacting with anger and righteous indignation to the world or to other people. So those symbols are not maybe what they might appear to be. They're not what they might appear to be. And no true Buddhist tradition would justify acting from anger as a skillful thing. That's not to say that Buddhists don't. I mean, I myself get angry and act from it. You have had in the Buddhist traditions sometimes people using Buddhism to act very unskillfully. So the Japanese, some Zen Buddhists in the Japanese tradition in the Second World War used Buddhist kind of teachings to justify the war effort. But it was a perversion of Buddhism. No true Buddhism would justify anger in its name or acting from it. Yeah. I don't know if you have anything to add.
Well, I was just wondering if it was worth distinguishing between anger and hatred.
Oh, yes, okay. Yeah, do you want to say more?
Well, I think I...
Because anger's not always a bad thing.
Well, that's what I was thinking. That you could, and I wonder if this also goes to the root of your point, that anger could be just a sort of energy that wants to change something and break through something. But often very quickly goes into hatred where it's ill will against somebody, and that's when it becomes unskillful. So I think if you can manage to do the very difficult thing of having that energy of breaking through without it going into hatred, you could argue that anger could be positive. But for most of us, most of the time, we haven't got that skill. You know, we go into like war and sort of intoxication or just on mindfulness with it, or you probably have to be quite a sort of mature, big sort of person to have, to be able to have anger and channel it skillfully and not let any ounce of ill will creep into it. Do you see the difference between the anger?
Yeah, there is.
So I think that's...
Yeah, it's a good distinction.
Maybe the distinction.
That's a good distinction.
It's the difference between the experience of anger reacting to it and externalizing it. So it's just listening to the anger rather than acting on the anger.
Well, you might act on it. I would even argue that you could act on it if you did so mindfully and not against somebody. You could still act, because in a way we're kind of talking about action.
Yeah.
So it could power your action, but as long as it didn't power it, as long as it didn't take over you, as long as kind of you took over it, as it were. So you're kind of, you're steering it and know where it's going. And that, I would say,
Well, certainly from me, I don't think I've ever managed to do that. Usually it's the tips to quit.
And I think another distinction is that anger can arise spontaneous, sort of spontaneously in the moment. Something is happening and there's a sort of surge of this hot energy. But I don't think it should be ever nursed. I don't think one then should deliberately think, let's stoke this, let's nurse it, let's get indignant about whatever it is. So it shouldn't be nursed in that sense, because then, if you're nursing it, it's turning into hatred. It's sort of turning into a fixed position that your ego is adopting, and that's a narrowing, as well as all the other things that might be harmful from it.
Yes, and somebody here a while ago, I'm not sure who it was, it may have been one of you or Matthew Bandel, he was talking about it, and the phrase he used, I think, was useful shame or skillful shame.
Yeah.
And he talked about, if, for example, if you've been putting something off, you know, like, you sort of know you should do something, and then you get cross with yourself and get angry, you're kind of like, do it, and you sort of get up and do it. And that's the energy I think you're talking about.
Yeah.
If you use it as an impetus to be something skillful.
Yeah, yeah.
But you also don't have that as a tool in the toolbox.
Yeah. Well, don't nurse it. Don't keep sort of sharpening it. But use it if it arises, perhaps. Yeah, that would be the distinction, I think, if you can. And that's the other distinction. It's very difficult. But what about the other side of it? What about this accusation about that Buddhism, therefore, just becomes passive and interned and not concerned about the world and its problems?
Even like with Muhammad, you know, he fought on the battlefield, but he prayed against bodies and whatnot.
Say that again, I didn't catch it.
Like in Islam with Muhammad, he fought on the battlefield and then prayed against the bodies.
Right.
And I saw this interesting footage of Barack Obama before he was president, saying that if we followed the teachings of Jesus Christ, our defence force would be wiped out one day. Read your Bibles, folks. You know, your New Testament. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, the reality is in its pure form. They all sort of come from the same place, really. Buddhism doesn't, so, you know, like in there, particularly with Christianity in its pure form, in non-violence. But in the world, though, the reality of the fact that we've been fighting since day one and haven't stopped, you know, the violence of non-action, like you were mentioning, I think that's the accusation that comes from people from the outside seeing Buddhism. You know, the pure pacifist, who is that violence in not responding in some force, actually. I don't know, but because in the reality is we're not all Buddhists.
So. Yeah. I think that there is this near enemy. And have you heard of the concept of far enemies and near enemies? It's a sort of model that I think is quite a useful model that's often used in Buddhism. A far enemy is the opposite of something good. So the far enemy of compassion would be hatred. Yeah? But the near enemy of something is often more difficult to spot. The near enemy of something looks like the virtue, but actually isn't the virtue. So the near enemy of compassion would be, what would it be?
Complacency.
Or something a bit like complacency, which sort of might feel connected, but doesn't do anything. Yeah? It's the near enemy of metta in a certain sense, where you can feel good, you can even feel for somebody, but it doesn't translate into action. A sort of feel-good complacency. It's got a sort of sentimentality to it. And I think that we, as people who meditate and who are trying to use the teachings of the Buddha in our lives, I think we've got to watch for those near enemies. I think we've got to watch for that complacency. I want to move on. But first I wonder if we could address your point. Do you want to ask it again?
Sure. How do we know which issues are real?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Yeah. Well, in a way, we've all got to come to our own judgment, haven't we? Because we're inundated with media telling us what's happening in the world, but that media is also being selective. And sometimes the media can sort of cook up an issue or exaggerate it, certainly. And I think we've all got to somehow be a little bit more, well, as discerning as we can. Discerning as we can. Now, there are obvious issues that are happening. If there is a war happening somewhere, or what's happening in Serbia or whatever, you know, it's not something that... it might be exaggerated, but it's not something that's being made up. But then there might be other issues which might not be such a thing. So, for example, I'm thinking of... in Britain, anyway, we're in a double-dip recession, aren't we? A double-dip recession. And yet, recently I was reading that more people... unemployment's fallen recently. And more people have found work, and the economists don't really know what's going on, why that's happening. Also, the definition of a recession is that the economy is dropping in its output. Now, correct me, I'm at the edge of my limits of knowledge here. But from a Buddhist perspective, the whole assumption of constant economic growth isn't necessarily a good thing. And even from an environmental perspective, to expect us to be constantly growing economically, we know is going to be unsustainable. So just to answer, that's an example of there is some issue going on, but it's not obvious what that issue is.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you have the governments, all the governments, who's trying to push their economy, because if everybody consumes, if you buy more and if you eat more, and your economy gets better, if you don't, it goes worse. So all the governments around the world, I think they're just pushing people to spend their money, consume more, and eat different things. So that's why I think their powerlessness comes from, because I think even whether whatever the culture is, if it's asked everyone on the street, they will be like reading off what we say.
Yeah.
But you have got these people who just seems like they're crazy and doing opposite of what everyone else thinks.
Yeah.
And you're just powerless against them.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't necessarily say we're powerless, but I think it's very, very difficult in a whole culture, and as you say, it's increasingly a global culture, which is just asking us to buy more and consume more, as if that will sort out all the world's problems. Somehow it will make us happier, and it will sort out the economies, and it will lead to some sort of paradise if we all keep buying the next gadget. That culture is very, very strong. It's very, very strong. The message is very, very all-pervading around us and increasingly globally. So I think it is difficult to stand against that. And in a way, I think that brings us to the first point that Sangharakshita Bhante talks about. What he says is, let me read it. He says, the only hope for humanity is therefore necessarily a long-term solution, involving more people becoming clearer about how they need to develop as individuals and cooperating in the context of spiritual communities in order, in various ways, to make a significant impact on the world. What he's saying is that the long-term solution, or the only solution, is a long-term solution, and it involves more and more people working on their own self-development as individuals, and then cooperating with other people who are also working on themselves as individuals, to form spiritual communities, that's what he calls them, that then can together maybe have some sort of impact on the world around. There are various terms there that I think are just worth making sure that we understand, because Banti uses them in a particular way. Yeah? And I'm just going to run through some of the terms. So the first term that I just want to clarify is, he doesn't refer to it in this sentence, but it's worth knowing, is he talks about the group. And we talked about this a few weeks back. Do you remember what Banti means when he talks about the group? He means group in a very particular sense. Do you remember what he means? Or know what he means?
The conditioned mass?
Yeah. Yeah, say a bit more, Sharon, can you?
Just how sort of brainwashed to conform to a certain way of being.
Yeah. So he means any collection of people who are not really thinking for themselves, but just following whatever the group norms tell them to do. Yeah, they're not. It's a sort of herd mentality, where we're all being sheep because it's easier to just follow the mass rather than think or act for ourselves. So a group is that conditioned mass, as you say, and then a group member is somebody who just goes along with the group, yeah, without thinking for themselves. So it's letting ourselves be conforming to whatever the group values are, and the group values might be the group might be as small as a family with its own values, or it might be our workplace, or it might be our social kind of circle, or it might be the whole nation following a particular kind of norm, or it could be even kind of global groups. It could be anything. Recently went to see, have you seen the film Searching for Sugar Man?
Yes.
It's really, really worth seeing. And some of that, it's about a sort of folk artist in the 70s who was an American folk artist, and he never made it big in America, although he was incredibly talented, and people were saying he was better than Bob Dylan. So he never made it in America, but somehow a bootleg copy of his album, his first album, made its way to South Africa, and he became a huge phenomenon in South Africa. But South Africa at the time was in the height of apartheid and had cut itself off from the rest of the world, and it was just this group that had its own values. And most people in South Africa just conformed, or felt compelled to conform. Most people just had, no kind of group, no individual kind of way of challenging the status quo. But his music, he was called Sixto Rodriguez, his music was anti-establishment music. And it started to sow seeds in a whole generation of white South Africans that they could question the status quo. And the film's fantastic. It just shows the effect of that. It shows how one individual, all the way in the States, unbeknownst to him, became the inspiration and a hero of a whole generation of white South Africans who were confined in this group mentality. And this individual who was just saying, you don't have to do what they say, in a beautiful, poetic way, was an inspiration that led to other white South African musicians who then, there was this whole underground movement, apparently in the 70s, of music in South Africa. Anyway, that's just an example of somebody inspiring people to start to think for themselves and to become a bit more individual. And individual is the term that Bante uses for people who do have their own value system and are thinking for themselves and taking responsibility for their actions, not following the group. So you've got a group, you've got group members, and then you've got individuals. And then what he says is that those individuals, if they are individuals and they find other individuals, then they'll band together. But they won't band together as a group would band together with coercion. They're just naturally drawn to other individuals. And that's what he says a spiritual community is. It's a collection of individuals who are supporting each other and working on themselves and helping each other work on each other. So it's not based on coercion, which is what a group is based on. So, all of that is leading up to him saying that there are four things that we can do as Buddhists in response to the world's problems. Four things. And the first one is to, he calls it self-development, to develop more and more individuality. To develop more and more individuality. And particularly, he says that this means the development of the mind and the raising of consciousness to ever higher levels of awareness. Yep. So let me just pause there and see. I've said something about the group member, the individual, and the spiritual community, his definitions of spiritual community, etc. And then he's saying that in answer to the world's problems as Buddhists, the first thing, there are four things, the first thing that he says is develop more and more individuality, self-development. So does that resonate with you? Do you see why that might be really, really important? Why he thinks it's the first thing? So why is it the first thing?
Well, for example, you're less likely to go off and join an army under coercion that's going to go and kill another army.
Yeah, because you're able to stand by your own values.
That's right.
Yeah. So you're less likely to be coerced into unskillful actions by the group. Yeah.
You can't change other people.
You can't necessarily change other people, that's true.
You can only change yourself.
Yeah, yeah. You might be able to influence other people, mm-hmm. but you can't force that change. You can only change yourself.
So you have to start with yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess if we don't start with ourselves, then we're not going to really be able to influence people around us very much. Because pretty soon they'll see that, well, we're as flawed as everybody else, and we're acting from our own egotism and selfishness as much as anybody else is. We're not going to be an inspiration, that's what I'm trying to say, that will influence others to also change. Yeah.
And it's difficult to practice values of honesty and compassion and kindness for other people if you don't have those values for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's like the metta bhavana, isn't it? That you have to work on developing kindness for yourself, and then you have to work on extending that, and then off the cushion you have to try and live that. And if we kind of do all of that, work on our own minds, and then work on acting from that, are we likely to be an influence for the good? So Bante talks about meditation as being an essential way of raising our level of awareness, raising our level of consciousness. And he talks about meditation in three ways. He talks about, firstly, meditation involving concentration, the integration of all our energies. So we're familiar with this whole notion of integration, and particularly things like the mindfulness of breathing, practices like the mindfulness of breathing, leading to a more integrated sense of ourselves. Then it involves the raising of consciousness to supraconscious dimensions. Supraconscious states that are transcending or leaving behind egotism. So meditation can open up more doors to these higher states of consciousness. That's his second kind of point about meditation. And then thirdly, meditation involves seeing into the depths of reality itself, seeing into the nature of the mind and reality itself. So all of those three kind of levels, if you like, of meditation are helping us become more and more of an individual, more and more of a positive, free, you could say, self-determining agent that can take responsibility for their own actions.
Yeah. Is there something, I keep thinking about perspective as well.
Ah.
I suppose in that self-development, I don't know how to put this into words, but it's like without that, everything's just on that level, isn't it? And everybody's just, like, I'm arguing that one thing's important, you're arguing that other thing's important, and it's just an argy-bargy, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
But somehow with, if you've managed to let go of egotism to some extent,
yeah,
you'd have a more panoramic awareness. Maybe it was about to, what you were saying about to see what is actually important,
yeah,
and what isn't,
yeah,
and have a different, some sort of different view on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Try to put it better, yeah, than that.
And a bigger perspective is also somehow a truer perspective, isn't it? Yeah. It's always a bit more objective and true and,
yeah,
real.
Yeah, maybe that's it's the objectivity, isn't
it's
it?
It's the objectivity, yeah, yeah. And to the extent that we're coming from our own egotistical position, yeah, we're losing that objectivity.
Yeah. Because sometimes we, and I've done it myself, and it's always easy to see in other people, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're sort of fighting for a cause, but you get the sense,
yeah,
that actually it's not actually the cause that matters, this just makes them feel,
yeah,
important in some way or,
yeah,
potent in some way.
Yeah.
But it's not objective, it's not,
yeah,
awareness.
Yeah. I can remember a friend of mine becoming absolutely passionate about the Palestinian cause, and sort of overnight, mm-hmm, becoming very, very passionate about it, to the point of going to Palestine, etc. And it was because he just started going out with a woman who was passionate about that cause. And when that relationship ended, Palestine didn't feature in his life at all. What was that? Anyway, you can sort of take my point. Yeah. But anyway, there's meditation of self-development, but that's not where it stops. He then says the more demanding aspect of self-development, as if meditation wasn't demanding enough, consists in what you do with the rest of your life in order to support your meditation. So he says you will look after your health. You will simplify your life as far as possible, dropping all of those activities, interests and social contacts, which you know to be a waste of time. So that's quite challenging, isn't it? So there's meditation itself, and then there's what you do to support your meditation. Look after your health, and you think, okay, I can go along with that. And then he says, yeah, simplify your life as far as possible, dropping all those activities, interests, and social contacts, which you know to be a waste of time. So that's strong. Then you will try to base your life, and in particular your livelihood, on ethical principles. So that's strong again. You've got to look at what you're doing to earn your money. You will make time, perhaps by working part-time, for study. For study of the Dharma, of course, but also for study of other subjects of general human interest, philosophy, history, science, comparative religion. And finally, you will find opportunities to refine and develop your emotions, especially through the fine arts. So, God, that's all a bit of a challenge, isn't it? So you meditate, you look at, in the light of meditation and its goals, you look at the whole of your life, the whole of your life, and you try and raise your ethical sensibility, your level of consciousness in all aspects of your life.
The urban retreat.
Urban retreat is the way to do that. In the 70s we didn't have them, so otherwise I'd have mentioned it. So that's under the first point of self-development. The other points are a bit shorter, but they're really, really important too. So he says the second thing, this is, remember, four things that you can do as a Buddhist in relation to the world problems. Join a spiritual community. Now, he doesn't mean necessarily a particular spiritual community. He means spiritual community in this sense that we've just talked about, which is a collection of other individuals or other people who are also trying to work on themselves and become more individual. So yes, he says this does not necessarily mean joining some sort of organized body or living under the same roof or any other living under the same roof. It simply means being in personal, regular and substantial contact with others who are trying to develop as individuals. It means being able to enjoy and seeking out not just the psychological warmth of the herd, but the challenge of real communication, genuine spiritual challenge. Yeah. So connecting, communicating, reaching out to people who are also trying to become more and more individual. So that's the second thing that he says. Partly, well, why do you think this is so important? Why do you think this is so important?
Well, there's a safety net, like a support group then that's there together while sharing a common goal or common vision.
Yeah.
And so with that support group, it helps each individual reach their desired state.
Yeah, that's very true. So it's a supportive environment for the group, and particularly if somebody is trying to go against the group mentality, those conformist kind of herd instincts, then it's very hard to do that if you're just a lone voice to stand against a crowd. And if you've got even just one other person that says, no, I can see what you're doing, that can be incredibly helpful. Incredibly helpful. So yes, it's very, very supportive. Are there any other reasons, though, that it might be really important?
We learn from each other.
Yeah, we do. We learn from each other. We learn from each other. And so, in a way, there's an opportunity to have both ourselves reflected back, because we've all got blind spots, but also we may be able to act as a mirror for somebody else and reflect them back. So we can be used to each other in that way. We learn from each other, that's right. Yeah.
What about the Buddha? He actually didn't. He was alone on himself. So, and I haven't ever seen any spiritual community who is actually true. It's not a group. Because it's idealistic. There's not such a group of true individuals. Always a lot of mixture.
It's a mixture, isn't it? Yes. Yeah, that's right. It's a mixture. Both really good points. So yes, you're right. What about the Buddha? Well, the Buddha did, in a way, do it on his own. And that's what makes him such an exceptional individual, even amongst other enlightened beings. Because, lots of other people became enlightened, even in his lifetime. But they all sort of looked up to the Buddha. Not that their enlightenment wasn't as good as his, but he'd done it on his own, whereas they did it by following his example, his teaching, his lead. So the Buddha does seem to have been an exceptional person. And it's not inconceivable that there might be other exceptional people who could do it on their own.
And maybe there is some very important aspect missing, like in modern life we have lost connection to the nature.
Yeah, we have.
So I don't know if Sangharishi ever speaks about, but it's kind of, I think that's important aspect. Nature is
important.
Spiritually teaching on its own.
Yeah. Well, we've been disconnected from that natural world around us, and I think that makes it harder. That makes it harder, particularly in an urban environment.
I think it's essential.
Yeah.
there's so many spiritual people actually living somewhere in nature. You just, you know, we don't ever see any spiritual community that lives somewhere, but you speak to them. And
I wouldn't know if it's essential. I wouldn't like to say that it's completely essential, but I think that for most of us, it's really, really important that we have time in supportive conditions, and that involves usually being in the natural world. Yeah. But to come back to your second point, I want to, so the Buddha being an exceptional individual, not inconceivable that there might be other exceptional individuals, but most of us aren't of that spiritual capacity that the Buddha seemed to have had. But then the second point is, are there real spiritual communities anyway? Are there real spiritual communities anyway? And I tend to agree with you that actually what you'll probably find is a mixture of, in any community, a mixture of kind of spiritual values and group values. Yeah? A mixture. Certainly that's true, I think, in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. And even in the Tri Ratna Buddhist order. The Buddhist order, the order, as order members, were meant to be trying to aspire to be a real spiritual community. But a lot of the time we fall short of being a real spiritual community, and it's easy to fall back into being a group. Hopefully the group that we fall back into isn't too harmful a group. Hopefully it's a sort of, what Banti talks about, a positive group. But nevertheless, it's still less than the ideal. So then, I think what you're faced with is having to be really intelligent, even in a so-called spiritual community. And it's something like, well, I can only speak about Tri Ratna, really, from experience. What I'd say is that I think that Tri Ratna, as a community, has a lot to offer anybody trying to become more of an individual. But you don't want to lose sense of personal responsibility. You know, you don't want to just say, oh yes, I'll give my life to whatever Nyanavacha says or Subhadramati says and believe them wholesale. You can't afford to do that because it's not perfect. And I don't think any collection probably is perfect.
Well, you can I say something? I've got something to say about both bits, actually, because I think what you can perfect is the effort to create the spiritual community.
Yeah.
So it's, rather than thinking almost I've got to find a perfect one to join, you can turn it around and become, try to become more and more perfect in your efforts to create it, which comes back to the personal responsibility, doesn't it? And I think that's, and the reason to do that, because there's the, like so far, maybe somebody's going to say this, but we talked about the sort of personal gain of being in a spiritual community, but then there's the gain to the world, which is what Banti's talking about, isn't it? But if you've got a community, that's going to have more effect on the world than you as an individual. Because in answer to, the Buddha didn't need a community to get enlightened, but as soon as he got enlightened, the very first thing he did was form an order.
Yeah, a community around him.
And that, because even that Buddha was only a person, and even an enlightened person, isn't enough on his own. He needed all those disciples to go out, didn't he?
And then when they became enlightened, he encouraged them to go out in different directions to help others and do that. I mean, this centre, for example, couldn't have been created were it not for a bunch of people gathering and forming a community. So Subhadramati or I or whoever couldn't be teaching here if we just did it, if we were doing it as individuals. I'd never be teaching. I'd sort of, you know, I wouldn't have created a centre. I'd have probably been doing something very, very, very much more ordinary with my life. So the power of that collective. I want to move on because there's just two more points. The third point, so he's talking about self-development, then banding together with others who are also trying to develop themselves. Then he says, withdraw support from all groups or agencies that actually discourage, directly or indirectly, the development of the individual. So withdraw support from those groups that are discouraging, actively discouraging, indirectly or directly, the development of the individual. So that's at least something that we can do, is not support those groups. Yeah? So look at what groups are we involved with in our lives, and think about that. I mean, thinking about anti-apartheid, so I was growing up in the 80s, and as a student in the 80s, you didn't have your bank account with Barclays, because they invested in South Africa. And it's a very small thing, but actually, enough students doing that had an effect on Barclays Bank. So you can have some power just by refusing to support particular institutions that you know are actively working against the development of individuals. And then the fourth one, which is encourage the development of individuality within all the groups to which one unavoidably belongs. So we are in groups. You'll find yourself in your workplace, in your family, in your social life, amongst people who won't necessarily support the development of you as an individual or individuality generally. And he's saying be subversive. In those groups that you're part of, when you can, in whatever way you can, encourage others to become more individual. Yeah? So he's saying undermine the system from within as best you can. He uses this rather unattractive analogy of earthworms. He says, be an earthworm. And he says, that might not sound very heroic or grand, but enough earthworms eating away under the soil can destabilize even a building because they you know, wreck the foundations. So he's saying you can do that in whatever way you can. So I'm going to just finish. Now let me just pause and see if there's any points from you about those four things. So there's self-development, joining, if you can, a spiritual community, then withdrawing support from all groups that aren't helpful, and then so sort of actively encouraging individuality in the groups that you are in. Yeah.
I'm going to say that it does require a certain amount of intelligent skill and knowledge to do this. It's because one can be very reactive in what you choose to
And it's got to be, you've got to use your judgment and be very, very careful. And you've got people like, well, the Pussy Riot, you know, punk band, they're trying to be subversive, and at the moment, it's backfired on them. On the other hand, they have got the eyes of the world on them. So it might be that, you know, they can really affect some change. But yes, you've got to be intelligent about it, and trying not to come from reactivity. Again, it comes back to this righteous indignation, and where are we coming from? Yeah.
But subversion, to be subversive, doesn't require you to be angry at it, does it? Because I have to pay attention though, because if I look around me, the image of subversives that I see is of militant, angry, furious people.
Sure.
And it's a lie, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not true. As you said, you can be subversive by being intelligent, by being calm, making wise choices.
Yeah. And perhaps just being, I don't know, I mean, I used to work in an environment, a corporate environment, where it was sort of commonplace to sort of lie. I don't know if that's your experience of your world of work, but it was sort of acceptable. Certain lies were acceptable, and particularly where truths were inconvenient. There would just be this kind of whole thing of dressing things up as, well, I don't know, just lying, actually, just lying. And you can choose not to participate in that. And that is an act of subversion. But you've got to be intelligent about it, yeah. I'm going to finish with this final kind of paragraph, where Bhante's saying that doing this is the most important thing that we can do. It's not just a personal concern. The world needs more and more people doing this. It's urgent. And he's saying that actually it's a matter of human survival. The extent of the world's problems now are such that unless we evolve in this way, we're unlikely to survive as a species. Now, I know that's a debatable point, but it's not too far-fetched. So let me just read what he says. Such a shift in the governing values of the world is probably all that can save us from extinction as a species in the not very distant future. There are certainly signs of hope, but there is also perhaps little time left. In this situation, it becomes the duty of every thinking human being to take stock of his or her position and the responsibilities that it implies. We have to appreciate that it is, without exception, the most important issue we shall ever face, either individually or collectively. It is certainly more important than any merely religious question, anything that concerns Buddhism in the sense of a formal or established religion. It concerns both the purpose and the very survival of human life. So I'm going to leave it there with his words, sort of ringing words of urgency to, in a way, look beyond ourselves, look beyond our own self-concerns. Look beyond, as he says, even what Buddhism is as a formal religion, to what it's trying to get at, essentially, and what implication that has on us as individuals living in a world. So we'll leave it there. Thank you. Good.